It's Thursday, October 7th, 2010. This is Religion of the Middle East. And we left off talking about Abraham. And we were talking about Abraham as the first Jew and also the first patriarch. And so the word patriarch has come up in a minute. PC. There we go. Can somebody dim the lights in front here? In the back? Or turn off the front, whatever works. Kind of flip the switches around so that there's no light here, but there's like light in the back. That'll work. These will show up better when I think. There we go. So the patriarchs are, the patriarch means father ruler. And so the patriarchs were sort of like tribal chieftains who ruled over God's chosen people. And those patriarchs are Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Jacob later gets his name changed to Israel and becomes the progenitor of the nation of Israel. The 12 tribes of Israel are each named after his 12 sons. So we have Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I mentioned before when God introduces himself to Moses, and Moses says, "Who are you?" And he says, "I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." And then he gives a special name, special personal name, Yahweh. And I mentioned last time that Abraham is originally named Abram, which means exalted father, and his name is changed to Abraham, meaning father of the multitude or father of many. He's promised by God that he will, if he cuts off the foreskins of the penises of all his descendants, that they will be as numerous as the seas, grains of sand on the seashore. So that's circumcision. For those of you not aware of it, you cut off the sort of sheath of skin on the end of the penis, and this is done in America for sort of bizarre puritanical hygienic reasons, going back to Kellogg, and there's all sorts of, there's a bizarre history of like why circumcision is practiced in the United States but not in in Europe. Did you have a question or comment?
When you were talking about Moses, when he's saying, you know, God gave me the name I am, or Yahweh, like in some translations says I am, like,
yeah, so
that's a mixed translation.
So the word, the phrase I am, it's kind of a wordplay on the name Yahweh. So the name Yahweh means something like the truly existent one, or he who causes to be, meaning he who maybe perhaps is created the universe. So there's a lot of associations with the name Yahweh have to do with the Hebrew word, which has to do with existence or being. And so when he says I am, tell them that I am sent you. That's kind of a wordplay on the name Yahweh.
So was it in the original text Yahweh, or was it I am in the Hebrew?
It is I am, but then it's I think when it says tell him I am sent you, there's some ambiguity there. So I have to look at the Hebrew text, but the implication is this is God's telling him his name, and his name is I am,
yeah.
And Yahweh means I am. So going back to the circumcision thing, circumcision was the only sign that you were a Jew and under the Abrahamic covenant. Remember, a covenant is an agreement between two parties in the biblical sense. It's a covenant between God and man, and a man's part, literally man's part, is that all the men are circumcised. And we even see with Moses doesn't circumcise his son, and for that reason, God actually comes after him to kill him. And his wife, Zipporah at the time, his first wife, ends up circumcising their son and throws the foreskin at Moses' feet and says, Am I not a groom of blood? And it's not clear exactly what that means, but the implication seems to be, Moses, you were supposed to circumcise our son. You didn't do it, so I had to do it, and here it is. But again, there's no, going back to circumcision, there's actually a big anti-circumcision movement in the United States because there's no real hygienic reason to be circumcised. It's not as if people in Europe have more infections than people in America. Cleanliness isn't really an issue. And the real reason it's done as a matter of course is this kind of puritanical streak in America and Kellogg and this sort of idea that if you circumcise children, they won't male children, they won't masturbate as much. So a little history on circumcision. So, and you do actually lose some sensitivity when you're circumcised. And today it's actually not done as a matter of course. You have the option to do it or not. Sometimes doctors will try to talk you into it, but it's now it's an option. It's not done as a matter of course. Okay, the covenant of circumcision, talked about that. Ishmael. Ishmael is a son of Abraham and Hagar, which is his handmaid. So they, Abraham and Sarah aren't able to have a child. And so what do you do when your wife is barren? Of course, you assume that it's the woman's fault. Not that you're impotent, but this woman isn't producing offspring for me. So you would traditionally bring in a servant or a household servant and try to sire a children with that child with that person. And so this is what Abraham does. And so this isn't very unusual in the culture. And they give birth to Ishmael. Ishmael causes strife in the Abraham household. And so to keep the peace, Abraham takes Ishmael when he's grown and takes him to northern Arabia where he is settled. And so Muslims today claim to be descendants of Abraham through Ishmael. And they say that Hagar was not a household servant, but was actually one of Abraham's wives. And Islam did begin in northern Arabia. However, it's highly unlikely that the people in northern Arabia in the 7th century when Islam began are the same people who are descended from people in northern Arabia at this time. People move around, and so it's not a done deal. But you can see people look back in that story and they said, oh, we're descendants of Abraham through Ishmael because Ishmael was settled right here where we live. All right. Sodom and Gomorrah story. Let's talk about this. And we're going to sort of, we're going to go up over this stuff a little briefly. This is a survey class. We have to do three religions. We're behind. So I might bust through this stuff pretty fast. Sodom and Gomorrah begins with God this saying, first of all, Abraham has three visitors. Who are those three visitors?
Two angels and God.
Yeah, two angels and God. Now, how do we know that? Well, does it say, and two angels and God visited Abraham in his tents? And it starts out as like three men, right? But later on, we see that it all of a sudden, Abraham starts addressing one of them as, or the one of them is referred to as Yahweh. And it says that Yahweh remains behind while the two men go into Sodom. And what God says is that, well, I've heard how wicked Sodom is, but I'm not really sure. So I'm going to send my angels in to kind of scout it out. So he sends these two guys in there for a little bit of recon to find out if things are as bad as he's heard they are. And again, this is a good example of anthropomorphism. When God shows up with the two angels, they're described as three men. God actually sits down with two angels, and Abraham feeds him dinner. They have conversation, and then he sends scouts out to find out stuff. Whereas if you think about God as a sort of all-knowing being, who's a sort of transcendent spirit, he doesn't need to send scouts out to find out stuff, right? He just knows it. And he's, you know, if he's a transcendent spirit, he doesn't have human form. And so this is what some theologians call an epiphany, a physical manifestation of God where he takes on human form. Although some theologians have suggested that in early Hebrew religion, God is thought to have some sort of physicalistic an anthropoid type of form. Like, and that when we read that God made man in his own image, that, you know, image there, we should take literally, you know, a head and two arms and two legs, like a human form. but having, you know, supernatural qualities and being the creator of the universe. Yeah.
Okay. Just a cross reference to the New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
It says in John 8:56, Jesus is talking to Jews at the time, and he says, "Your father Abraham rejoiced to see my day, and he saw it and was glad." Some people speculate that it could have been God in the flesh or Jesus with two angels visiting Abraham.
Mm-hmm.
Just one of the ideas of who Yahweh was in physical character.
Okay, an interesting idea. That there might be some other explanations for that. Rejoice to see my day. I mean, this is something about this going to happen in the future, right? So, and it says he saw it. Is that sort of a vision, or what does it mean when he rejoiced to see my day? Because that didn't seem like it would fit the visitation. I'll still have to think about that one. I'll see what else happens in that story that might, you know, be seen as Abraham seeing the day of the Messiah.
Well, after it, the later verses say, like, the Jews said, "Well, you're not even 50. How did you see him?" And then he goes on to say, "Before right. Abraham was, I am."
I am, right. Which is, I think, again, a play on the name Yahweh.
Yeah.
Right. So, all right. Thanks for that. Moving right along. So Abraham's two visitors, Yahweh and two angels. What is Sodom's sin? Oh, yeah.
Sorry.
You'll go ahead.
The cross-reference, a lot of people believe it was sodomy, homosexuality. But others say that they were not only, I mean, they were homosexual, but they were not just homosexual, they were rapists. They were trying
right.
to rape. But the reason in Ezekiel it says Sodom was destroyed was because she did not help the poor or needy. They were haughty and committed abominations. So the main gist they gave was, you know, these people aren't helping each other and they're just being cruel to one another.
But there's also the bit about the abominations.
Yeah. I'm not excluding that.
So, you know, were there other people that are haughty and proud that didn't get fire and brimstone showering down on them from heaven? And it seems pretty clear, you know, part, you know, Ezekiel is not, you know, the author of the story. So he's looking back on this and giving his interpretation of what their sin was.
Right.
If you look at the story itself, you know, what's, yeah.
Well, in the story itself, what we were assigned to read, it kind of bothered me at one point. I don't know if I'm understanding it right, but all the men of Sodom came to the door and said, you know, give us the two men who came with you so that we may have sex with them.
Uh-huh.
And then Lot, I guess, says...
offers them his daughters.
Yeah, here,
right.
two virgin daughters.
Sure.
You want.
Pretty bad guy.
Yeah, is that...
Yeah,
that's
yeah. He's. I mean, you look at like back when they came into the land, Abraham, and they were going to split up the land because their groups were too big. And Lot basically said, "I'll take the good land." And so he went off and lived in Sodom, and Sodom was, and he just lived among them, and it was pretty unrighteous. And then you see that like he offers his daughters, and there's another backsliding, and then eventually he. His daughters like get him drunk and have sex with him, and that's like his third and final backsliding.
But another thing to keep into consideration is the context of the culture. In Middle Eastern culture, that hospitality is seen as a sacred duty that you need to support over even the safety of your own family. So once you take a guest into your house, you're obligated to defend that person. And so Lot, you know, maybe made a bad choice, but in context, he's thinking, "Well, I got an angry mob of gang rapers out there. I have a guest I need to protect. They're going to break down the door. What am I going to do? Well, I guess I'll send out my daughters to him and see if that's going to make him happy and protect my guest." So that's the from Lot's point of view, and so. And you know, what is this? Notice that when the two men show up, right, that Lot actually shows that he is different from the men of Sodom, that he actually is righteous. that he, first of all, the men, they're going to camp out in the public square. This is the two angels, right? So the angels are going to camp out in the public square. And this, you know, there's not a lot of hotels and motels in the ancient world. So usually you'd come to a new city and there'd be sort of a big public square and you would just kind of like put down your bedroll and just, you know, go to sleep there. And Lot says, it's not safe. You know, this is like a felony flats, right? Over by the Applebee's. You can't sleep here. This is like, you know, this is like that sleeping under the bridge in Lebanon. It's not safe. You need to. And so he takes them into his house, showing what a good guy he is. So I think that the story and the author means to portray Lot in sort of a good light. And notice that Lot and his family are the only ones who are saved from the city. There's not. And when we see going to the haggling over Sodom and Gomorrah, we see that Abraham haggles with God and gets him down to 10 people. He starts out with 50. Well, and Abraham kind of gives a lecture to God. He says, look, are you going to destroy the righteous with the unrighteous? Or are you just going to, like, you know, wipe out all these innocent people? And he's like, how about, what if there are like 50 people? Are you going to kill 50 innocent people? And God says, okay, well, if you can find 50 innocent people in Sodom and Gomorrah, I won't destroy the city. And then Abraham says, well, how about, what do you think about 40, right? And he goes down and finally says, oh, Lord, please do not be angry, but how about 30? And finally he gets him down to 10. And so God says, okay, that's as low as I'll go, 10 people. And he can't even find 10 people. So the city gets destroyed, but Lot and his family are still saved. And so it's pretty clear. Some people have suggested that the sin wasn't really homosexuality, but it was inhospitality, that they're not taking care of guests. But I think when you have the episode with the virgin daughter shown, that it's not just their roving bands of rapists that want to gang rape any stranger that has the bad luck to wander into town, but it's a gang raping homosexuals that's sort of made a big deal of. And that's illustrated, I think, by the fact that not only do they not want Lot's daughters, but their virgin daughters, which, like, any, you know, red-blooded heterosexual male is going to want to have sex with a virgin, but they don't even want the virgin daughters. They want to have sex with the men. And when it says, I think the King James says something like that they lusted after strange flesh. And some people have misinterpreted this to think that the men of Sodom actually know that these are angels, when in reality, it's just talking about, in the Hebrew, it's talking about foreigners. So the idea, there's kind of exotic, right? They're like from another area. It's kind of some fresh fish or whatever, you know. You know what I mean? It's the you know, somebody who's sort of like from another country, you know. I guess they want to, you know, gang rape the guy, you know, that looks a little different than the people in Sodom, the out of towner. So, you know, they're tired of gang raping the locals because they gang raped them before, I don't know. So it's pretty. So they're pretty corrupt, and it's pretty clear that, I mean, homosexuality was an extreme taboo in Jewish culture. You would be put to death for it. And it's sandwiched in between commandments against having sex with an animal and having sex with your daughter or son. So pretty serious sin. And when finally you know, the angels miraculously blind the men of Sodom and they escape and they go out. Lot's wife turns around and is turned into a pillar of salt. And some historians, anthropologists will say, if you look at the Dead Sea area, you see these sort of stalagmites. Remember, stalagmites are the things that come up from the ground. Stalactites hang down from the, like, a cave wall or something. So you have all these stalagmites coming up, and so your anthropologist or secular scholar is going to say that these are sort of legends that built up around these pillars of salt, that these are the people that looked back on Sodom when it was destroyed and God turned them into pillars of salt. There are a lot of sulfurous gases there. You have gases there, which could, like methane, which natural gas seeps, which might have ignited, and that might actually have caused the appearance of fire and brimstone coming down from heaven. So one explanation for how this story got started, assuming it's not a miracle, or maybe it's a miracle that God did using naturalistic phenomena, is that it's some sort of natural gas explosion which destroyed the city of Sodom and the area there. If you ever go to Israel, it's kind of neat to you can float in the Dead Sea. It's just got so much, and this is around the Dead Sea area. They haven't found the city, but its geographic description is around the Dead Sea area. And you can actually go out in the Dead Sea and kind of like be in the water and kind of put your arms like that. And there's so much salt in there, you'll kind of float around without sinking. Okay, I think that's it for Sodom and Gomorrah. Any questions or comments about Sodom and Gomorrah? Again, anthropomorphism. Abraham's haggling with God. God's changing, sort of changing his mind, or at least making it seem like it, and what he's going to do, even though it probably ends up what he intended to do anyway. But at least he's willing to sort of haggle with Abraham the way you'd haggle with somebody in a marketplace. Note that when Abraham says, "You're going to destroy the righteous with the wicked," God doesn't say, "Who are you to question me?" He's like, "Okay, well, let's talk about this." And again, this sort of familiar portrayal of God as being more human-like. Whereas in the book of Job, for example, God appears at the end of the book of Job and appears in a whirlwind and lectures Job in 5 pages about how I'm God, you're not. Don't ask me questions. You should. And Job sort of shuts up and repents after when God shows up. And the relationship between Abraham and Yahweh seems much more familiar. Let's talk about the sacrifice of Isaac. So remember, the promise to Abraham is you're going to be the father of a mighty nation. Change his name to Abraham. That means father of many or father of a multitude. Isaac's described as his beloved son. And so, what does he do? He asked Abraham to sacrifice Isaac as sort of a loyalty test. And he says, after, and in the story, he leads Abraham, Abraham leads Isaac to the sacrifice, and Isaac says, "Father, where's the sacrifice?" And you get this cryptic statement, "The Lord will provide," or "Yahweh will provide." What does that mean? A cryptic statement mean, yeah, God's going to provide, he's going to provide you? Or is it just trying to, slough off his question? Or does Abraham have faith that God's not going to make him go through with this? Whatever it is, they show up at Mount Moriah. Abraham's got the knife. He's ready to probably draw it across his son's throat. Typically, when you slaughter an animal, you'd sever the jugular, so you'd go around the throat and you'd sort of come from behind and draw it across. If you ever want to kill someone quickly, that's the best way to do it. If you can get around them, just go like this with a sharp object, and they're pretty much toast. So anyway, this is the way you do an animal. I actually had a friend who slaughtered a goat telling me about that, and he's like, "Well, the goat was bleeding, Jeff. It was just like a human being." This guy grew up in the Philippines. It was like a traumatic experience when he was a kid slaughtering a goat, but he's like, you grab the goat, and the goat's like kind of thrashing around, and he's... So he's getting ready to kill his son Isaac, and just as he has the knife just ready to draw it across his throat, an angel comes in and stays his hand and says, "Wait, it was just a test." And God says, "Now I know that you truly fear me." And so I suppose the question, I ask a couple of questions, and maybe I'll ask two to start out here. If God really is omniscient, why does he need a loyalty test for Abraham? And the second question is about, that whether this seems like an ethical command. If God asked you to kill your beloved son or your roommate or your girlfriend and make them into a human sacrifice, what would be your reaction? And Isaac.
Sorry, ironic. I got a couple notes here.
Mm-hmm.
Brett. So the typical lesson here is that Isaac, if you're abiding by Christian doctrine, the lesson you can take from here is Isaac is a type of Christ obedient unto death. Then Abraham is a type of father who spared not even his only son, but delivered him up for us all. And then the ram is a type of substitution. Christ offers as a burnt offering in our stead. And then there's some Crawford references. And then another note on the loyalty test was If you look prior to this, God promised him a son when they were old and barren.
Mm-hmm.
And Abraham had faith, and God came through. So, I mean, he already passed the faith test right there, and then, or God already proved that, you know, he does what he says. And then he made a covenant through Isaac, saying, you know, I'm going to bless you with descendants through Isaac. So Abraham, probably being a logical man, if God already blessed me with a son when I knew I couldn't have one, and then he says that I'm going to have generations through him, I'm pretty confident that Isaac has to stay alive. So Abraham again had faith, and God delivered. So in the same manner that God knows Abraham's faith also assures him. So he's basically saying that, you know, through faith I gave you a son, through faith I'm going to give you many nations, and then this is the final thing, through faith I'm going to deliver your son.
And Abraham really knows that it's just a test because it goes against this other promise
God
made.
Well, he doesn't know. He has faith.
But it seems like if you're saying that Abraham, it sounds like you're thinking that it's not really faith, but he has evidence over past experience with God. God's made him this promise, and then God gives this command, which conflicts with this promise. It seems like he's making a logical deduction. That seems different from faith. It seems like a kind of crazy commandment, right? If I tell you, I don't know, because I think of an analogy here. Maybe ever go down to the Cottage Grove Speedway and do any racing. Suppose I say, we're going to go to the Cottage Grove Speedway and we're going to win that race. And like we spend, you know, the better part of a year building like a supercharged race car. And then I say, okay, we're going to drive the car up to the hills, and we're going to drive it off a cliff. And what I want you to do is like drive it like really, really fast and then bail out at the last minute and go over a cliff. And you think, well, wait a minute, that's crazy, right? And this is the same sort of thing that God's doing. He's giving this crazy command. And there's a philosopher named Soren Kierkegaard. Sorry, God. God gives him this kind of crazy command, right? And Soren Kierkegaard writes about this in a book called Fear and Trembling. It's the whole book's about Abraham and Isaac. And this idea that faith requires you to believe in the absurd, and that... And on the ethical question, that God is sort of the ground of morality, and that God's commandments abrogate all other commandments. They abrogate all of the other moral obligations because God's the ground of morality. And so if God commands, it's by definition, it's right and good. Yes?
So basically, not following it logically is the only way to really understand it.
Well, I mean, think about it. Like, Abraham's told, you're going to be the father of a multitude. And then he's like, he waits till he's like 80 years old or 100 years old, and finally he has this son. And there's like the first son, right, that's by the handmaid, and that doesn't work out because he doesn't get along with the wife, so he's gone. And so he's finally got this son that he really loves. And then God says, okay, I want you to sacrifice your son as a human sacrifice, like you'd sacrifice an animal, and kill him. Right? And this is after, you know, that Abraham and Sarah are even older. And what's Abraham supposed to think? But Abraham's reaction to the story is like, okay, God. And he just goes and does it. And God is proud of him for following through. But what about the second question? Like, if you heard a voice, you know, that you took to be God or claimed to be God and told you to commit to make a human sacrifice, what would you think?
I better be freaking sure.
He already had dinner with God. I mean, I think that would be a pretty firm, substantial thing, you know. And he's witnessed, I mean, tons of miracles through God. I think his faith in God is...
Will you do anything that person told you to after that? I mean, what if he said, you know, I don't want you to sacrifice, but I want you to torture him first. Right? Before you kill him, I want you to torture him. Yeah?
Okay. The first thing I saw in the story, I think, was that Abraham circumcised everyone in his household and himself.
Right.
When God told him to.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that...
That's kind of drastic.
From what I hear, that's not a very...
Especially when he's that old.
Kind of painful. And,
yeah,
you know,
sure.
Why would God need another test of loyalty after something like that? Because it's, you know... And it just kind of feels like, I don't know, maybe it was... It doesn't feel like a test of loyalty to me.
Well, it's kind of like, think about, like, if you're joining a gang, right? And the first thing they do is, like, everybody in the gang, like, takes turns beating you up. They take you in an alley, and, like, everybody, like, slugs you, you know, and you got to sit there and just take it. And that takes a lot, right? That might be analogous to the circumcision. And you're like, okay, well, you'll take a beating from the gang. Okay, now we're going to do a drive-by, and you got to shoot your cousin or your brother or maybe just some, like, random SOB, right? So you do the drive-by. And if you're willing to kill for the gang and maybe, like, shoot your cousin that you're, like, really tight with, that shows you're tight with the gang. You'll do anything that they tell them to. And that's kind of like the idea here is that God wants to make sure Abraham's loyal. And so what does he do? He gives him a commandment that he knows Abraham really, really, really doesn't want to do. And if he does it, that shows that he's loyal and he'll do anything God tells him to. And that's seen as the height of virtue. It's obedience. And it's not thinking about larger ethical principles. And it's not sort of, you know, thinking about it or considering, you know, people's rights or about the greater good. It's all about obeying God's commands. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess I would, like, kind of agree with that. But you're saying maybe God was, through that, was trying to just make sure that he was still first in Abraham's life and that through giving him a son, he didn't elevate or love Isaac more than Abraham, or more than...
Yeah, God, you know, Yahweh's a jealous God. He doesn't want you caring about anything more than him and obedience to his commandments. Yes, sir?
Real quick, stepping back to the circumcision story... it's possible that maybe God was testing all the people who were getting circumcised and not just Abraham, so that would make more sense. Because I know if he was like, hey, for circumcision, I'd be like, whoa, Buddhism! You know, like,
yeah.
Yeah, that'd be hard.
Anyway, a lot of people look at this and they find it kind of, you know, troubling that God would issue this kind of command in the first place as kind of a test to probably put Abraham through some... it put him in a tough situation. And imagine, like, the relationship between Abraham and Isaac after this, right? I think I'd always be looking over my shoulder, like, Dad, here, got another message from God. Yeah.
Yeah, so in the book of Genesis, it says that those who kill will be killed, right?
Right, right.
So wouldn't Abraham be worried about that as well?
Yeah, I suppose you get that. But if God tells you, I mean, there isn't this idea that there's, like, here's the rules of morality, and then here's, like, you know, what God tells me to do. It's what God tells you to do is the rules of morality. And God can kind of tell you to do something different than the usual course of events. He's sort of in charge, and he can abrogate or give you an exception or tell you to do something different than what he told you to do yesterday. So you get you first, and then you... Yeah.
Well, would Abraham really know about that since Moses wrote the first part of the Bible?
Well, it's a question. We don't know that Moses wrote the first part of the Bible. We don't know. I mean, the book of Genesis, there's nothing that's talked about Abraham knowing about that. Abraham grew up in Ur of the Chaldees, so he's...
He's probably polytheist before he became a monotheist. He said with the speculation in the Jewish religion that he basically worshipped the moon and then he... logistically came that that's not the right one and eventually came to Yahweh when he was like 70.
Is that, what is it?
And became a monotheist and then... So he's speculating that he wasn't even like a part of the Jewish culture.
Yeah, so he's sort of a convert. He hears the call of Yahweh when he's living in pagan culture. But maybe there's this general idea of, you know, Yahweh revealed that it's something that's generally believed or known that you get the death penalty for murder. But it's something that's sort of unusual, right, that you kill your own son, and it's something that's really hard, would be really hard command to go through, and that's the point of it, right? God wants to find something that Abraham really, 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 really doesn't want to do. What does Abraham love most in the world? His son. So what's the commandment? You know, destroy your son, kill your son, destroy that which you love most. And if you do that, that shows that the most important, that you're truly loyal and you'll do anything I command you. Yeah, did you have one? Okay. So the emphasis on obedience, on God triumphs over right and wrong. I would think, you know, if I heard a voice coming to me in the middle of the night that told me to, kill my wife and, you know, cut out her organs and burn them up on the stove or something like that. Yeah, I might think it's like a Satan or demon or maybe that I should check myself into a mental hospital or something. Yeah, but there's this interesting question about how do you know whether God's speaking to you or whether Satan's speaking to you. And later on when we get to Muhammad had problems knowing the difference between the two. And it gets into a bit of trouble. Okay, Jacob and Esau. Why isn't he the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Esau? Is somebody who hasn't talked before want to tackle this one? So when God introduces himself, he says, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But the firstborn son of Isaac, who was traditionally the next patriarch, was Esau. It wasn't Jacob. Yeah.
Esau was tricked out of his birthright.
Right. So Esau is tricked out of his birthright, and how's that done?
He comes in really hungry.
Yeah, no, he says, like, I'm so hungry I could die, but it's, you know, that's kind of like I'm famished. It's not like he's going to, like, plunk down, you know, face down in the kitchen and be dead. So he's just, you know, it's an idiom for, like, I'm really, really hungry. Jacob's kind of a mama's boy. He's in there cooking in the kitchen. He doesn't have any, like, body hair. He's always hanging around his mother. He and his mother are conspiring against the brother. And he's in there cooking, and so he's like, I'll trade your birthright for a bowl of soup. What do you think? He's like, okay. And this shows that Esau's probably not fitted to be the next patriarch either. It says that Esau thus despised his birthright. So although Jacob is portrayed as being tricky and sneaky and ambitious, Esau is seen as kind of dumb. And, you know, he's kind of a man's man. He's hairy. He's, you know, goes out and hunts like a man. And that thus he's his father's favorite. But he's kind of thick in the head and doesn't make good decisions. So, and so it's interesting here that all of Jacob's sort of shiftiness and sneakiness is here. Jacob's also very ambitious. His name, his very name Jacob, it means heel grabber. And so when Esau and Jacob are being born, they're fraternal twins. And so Esau is like coming out of the birth canal first. And as he's coming out, Jacob's hand like comes out as if trying to grab hold of Esau's heel and pull him back into his mother and crawl out so he's the firstborn and gets to be the next patriarch. And we see all throughout his life, Jacob is a sort of sneaky, conniving, but very ambitious person, kind of like a politician, I guess. Yeah.
I was wondering why that was rewarded.
That's a good question. Someone have a thought on that? Why is Jacob rewarded for being sneaky and crafty?
There's
this underhanded.
There's a theme like throughout the Old Testament. You can see like Isaac wasn't the firstborn. It's always about this, like, the older shall serve the younger. You see that with Jacob's kids. You have Joseph being one of the younger ones, and eventually they all serve him. So it's like this reversal of society expects the older to get the birthright, but God kind of humbles them and says, you know, the younger's going to get them. Also, it's speculated that Esau was more of a worldly man. Like, he despised his birthright. He didn't really care. And Jacob, like, really wanted that and kind of wanted favor and... Is that right?
Yeah, I think the concept of worldliness is more of kind of a Christian concept. But here definitely, he says he despises his birthright, so he's not a very honorable person. He's kind of thinking in the short term. And so if you had to pick between, it's kind of like, I'm trying to think of a good example. I'm trying to think of okay, if I had to pick the next president, and my choices were Richard Nixon and Jimmy Carter, you know, Nixon was actually not a very good president, and he was sneaky and dishonest and underhanded. But Carter was just a total disaster. So if I had to pick one, I think I'd go with Nixon, because Nixon at least had some ideas of foreign policy, and he wasn't just totally incompetent like Jimmy Carter was. So even though Nixon was kind of dishonest and maybe he was a crook, I pick him over Carter. So maybe God sort of, if he's got two people, one's kind of sneaky and dishonest, but he's really ambitious and he has his priorities in line, and the other guy is like this dumb hunter who's willing to give away his entire birthright for a bowl of soup. You know, maybe he goes with Jacob. This is what I just covered here, so I didn't cover up my PowerPoint. So, Jacob, the mama's boy, no body hair, likes to cook, clever, sneaking, conniving, and again, ambitious from the womb. And so, to add insult to injury, he not only trips Esau out of his birthright, but he gets the blessing from his father. So the blessing, you as the last patriarch was about to die, it's kind of like a coronation ceremony. You would pass on the right to be patriarch to the next person, the person who had the birthright. And so, again, you know, Rachel is conspiring with Jacob and shows up there, and he puts like an animal pelt over his arm, and Isaac is blind at the time.
Rebecca.
Sorry, Rebecca. Thanks. So Rebecca is sort of working with Jacob, and puts this pelt over his arm. So Isaac, who's blind and, you know, about to give up the ghost, is kind of feeling around. Oh, it's the hairy arm. That must be my manly man son that he's like, you know, like you can see my hairy arm here, right? I'm kind of a hairy guy. And you look at somebody like you have some of it, but it's kind of lighter, right? You can see people will vary. And so, you know, he didn't feel the smooth arm of Jacob. And so he gives him the blessing, and then Esau comes in and says, "Okay, Dad, I'm ready for my blessing." And Isaac says, "What? Oh, no." You know, he realizes he's been tricked. And so Jacob gets to be the next patriarch. Esau gets upset for a while and is sort of on a revenge quest, but eventually the brothers reconcile. So Jacob becomes the firstborn, again tricking Esau's blessing and and also out of his birthright. The birthright and the blessing. And so Jacob is renamed. And there's this other episode where God actually meets Jacob and the two of them wrestle. Again, this is God having human form or taking on human form, and they wrestle till dawn. And what happens is God dislocates Jacob's hip. And if you've ever had a joint dislocated, like a shoulder or something like that, anybody ever had that happen? Was it painful? Very painful, right? It, you know, goes outside. So imagine like having your hip dislocated. It's extremely painful. But what happens is Jacob's like holding on. He's not going to let go, even though he's in agony, and they wrestle till dawn, and Jacob won't let go of the hold. And this really, again, this shows his ambition. This really impresses God. And so he changes his name from Jacob to Israel, which means he who wrestles with God. Because you've wrestled with God and man and prevailed. So so this he becomes the, you know, again, he's already the next patriarch, but God, again, giving someone a new name which fits their nature. And Jews have looked at this metaphorically as the Jewish people have always been wrestling with God. God describes them as a stiff-necked people that can't follow orders, and he has to punish them all the time to get them to fall in line. And throughout history, we can see the Jewish people wrestling with God over following the commandments.
What was that last?
Sorry, good question.
The very last line
there. Oops, there it is. Oh, Jacob renamed Israel. All right, the Exodus. We have the Exodus? We are. Well, let's take a break. Let's take ten minutes. Okay, so here's part two. Moving right along, talk about the Exodus. Close this up. I should have closed this up before we get started. Here, any questions or comments? Oh, did you have something, Isaac? You want?
Oh, no, it's fine. I figured it out.
Okay, what is this? That's not what I wanted.
Best comic I've ever had.
Yes. Okay, here we go. So, people listen online, we're going to be talking about some of these comics. You want to download the PowerPoint. So we've got a comic here with Moses, obviously there with the commandment tablet in either arm. And he's talking to God. He says, now let me get this straight. The herbs get oil, and we have to cut off the ends of our butt. So, play on the circumcision commandment, remember? And actually that. Now, what is theologically or biblically inaccurate about this cartoon?
He got oil.
Arabs get the oil. Yeah.
Well, Arabs did get the oil, all right. But that's maybe anachronistic, right?
Because the circumcision wasn't a commandment. It was covenant before.
Right, it was with Abraham, right? So yeah. By the time Moses gets there, it's, you know... Now, I suppose you could say Moses didn't get this on Mount Sinai as a commandment, though. It wasn't. It's not one of the Ten Commandments. And he did have to... In Exodus 4, it's clear that he was supposed to do it and didn't. And God tries to kill him in Exodus 4 for not circumcising his child. So it's still seen as a commandment, but it's something started with Abraham, not Moses. Synchronized swim meet deal. I guess it's the Olympics, right? So there's a number four out in the lead because, and that's Moses in the background there, parting the swim the pool waters there, as in the Exodus. Right? 40 years. Why did the Israelites wander 40 years in the wilderness? And the joke here is that Moses is a typical man and won't stop to ask for directions.
Oh my God.
And finally, Mrs. Moses has the woman who doesn't have an ego problem goes and asks for directions. So, what's the real reason that the Israelites had to wander 40 years in the wilderness? That's a joke here. Yeah, so when they went to spy out the land,
saw giants.
Yeah, there's a giant. They said, there's giants in the land. We are as grasshoppers in their sight. These people are too great for us to conquer. And so they didn't trust that God would give them the victory over the people in Canaan. And since that was the minority report that said, you know, God's on our side, of course we're going to win. But the majority decided that it wasn't going to happen. And so God forces them to wander in the wilderness for 40 years until the faithless generation who didn't believe that God would give them victory over their enemies had died off. And then Moses ends up, although very old, ends up being barred from the promised land for a different reason. A couple of pigs talking. Personally, I wish the whole world were Jewish, right? Why? Now, why does he wish the whole world were Jewish?
It's unimportant.
Right, Jews are forbidden from eating pigs.
Leviticus, right?
Right, in the book of Leviticus, they're seen as the quintessentially unclean animal that you're not allowed to eat.
Obviously, they never had bacon.
Right, so it's the rule for large land animals that they have to have cloven or split hooves, and also they have to chew the cud. So the cloven and split hooves, so the pigs do have the cloven hooves, but they're not grazing animals. Pigs are omnivores, so they don't chew the cud, which is what grazing animals will eat grass and kind of they'll chew it and swallow it. It'll go down to like a multiple chamber stomach, and then they regurgitate it and chew it some more. And so, but basically it's talking about grazing animals. Like one of the unclean animals is a rabbit. So you can't eat rabbit as a Jew because although it chews the cud, it doesn't have cloven hooves. It's got furry feet, right? So cats, you can't eat a cat or a dog because they have feet. They don't have hooves. And it's got to be a split hoof. It can't be like a single hoof like a horse. A horse is an unclean animal. Okay. So the Exodus. When did the Exodus happen? Well, there's two dates. The Exodus 1450 date is the, and basically, 14. I think that if you want to put an exact number on it, 1446 is the conservative date. 1250 is more of the liberal date. Exodus 1450 fits with the biblical chronology. There's a passage in the book of Kings, I think 1 Kings 6. In the book of Kings, it tells you how many years it's been since the Exodus. And if you follow that back, you get a date of 1446. Some of the later dates given, we'll mention, like, there's a city of Ramses is mentioned, and people say that shows that, you know, Pharaoh Ramses was a 13th century pharaoh, so the Exodus couldn't have been in the 15th century B.C. But it might just be like it's a reference to the area that people knew as Ramses when they were writing this down, and it's kind of an anachronistic reference. Like, I might say, the Indian tribes who lived in Oregon, right? Well, there were Indian tribes in Oregon before Oregon was called Oregon, but we still refer to it as Oregon, right? Or I might talk about people coming across the land bridge from Alaska 50,000 years ago. Well, it wasn't called Alaska, right? So I don't know if that proves anything. But you should just be aware of the two dates. Just generally, I'm not going to ask a lot of questions on dates. I think the only dates I want you to know are 70 AD and 1948. But just to get an idea of what happened when, these are the two dates that are generally given. So Jacob, also knows Israel, right? Yeah.
Really quick, 70 AD and 1948 or what?
The two dates I want you to remember. Well, we haven't got to those yet.
Is it 1948 Israel becomes a nation?
Right. 1948 Israel becomes a nation again.
The temple,
the destruction.
Right, exactly. Hey, you guys are ahead of the game. So Jacob has 12 sons. Jacob, who's named Israel, has 12 sons. They become the 12 tribes of Israel. They're the progenitors of the 12 tribes of Israel. Now, speaking of sons, I think I left out something about Lot. You mentioned this before, Lot having sex with his daughters. And you can see that, again, as another etiological story. You might say, okay, why are the Ammonites and the Moabites? Why are the Ammonites and the Moabites so corrupt? And the answer is, they're inbred, right? They're a bunch of inbred degenerates. And why? Well, because Lot's daughters thought it was the end of the world. There was no husbands for them, and so they got their father drunk after Sodom and Gomorrah, and gave birth to the Moabites and the Ammonites, who are traditional enemies of the Israelites. Okay, so Joseph, who's one of the 12 sons of Jacob, gets sold into slavery. I didn't give you this section to read just because it's kind of a long story. But you may be familiar with it. It was made into an Andrew Lloyd Webber, I think, musical. Joseph in his Technicolor green coat, although it wasn't Technicolor. But he had this fancy coat, and he was his father's favorite. The brothers were jealous, so they fake his death. They make it look like he was devoured by wild animals, and then they sell him to Egyptian slavers. But paradoxically, this ends up being good for the Israelites, because this is a story which explains how the Hebrews, who are in the land of Canaan, end up going back, how they end up settled into Egypt at the beginning of the book of Exodus. And so the end of Genesis tells you how the Israelites, the descendants of Israel or Jacob, and the descendants of Abraham, how they got up into Egypt. And so Joseph is sold by his brothers into slavery. He ends up being in a household where he's falsely accused of adultery, ends up in the dungeon. There he meets another guy who's there for something else.
The bread maker,
right. Right, and finds out that the Pharaoh's been having some troubling dreams. And Joseph says, well, I can interpret dreams. And so an important dream that the Pharaoh has is that he sees a bunch of fat cows and a bunch of thin cows, and the thin cows eat the fat cows. And then he has this vision of grain, and he has a vision of grain that's healthy, and there's a vision of grain that's withered. And the essence of this dream is that there will be 7 years of plenty followed by 7 years of famine. Well, during the 7 years of plenty, the Egyptians, you know, unlike Oregon or the United States, during the boom time, they say, oh no, we got this famine coming. We better store up grain, store up food, get ready. And so when the famine comes along, they're ready for it. Although it's still kind of hard. And so the brothers actually come up there to try to get some food, and Joseph does this kind of trick where he hides like a goblet in the younger brother's backpack, and then accuses them of stealing, and then all of a sudden reveals himself because they don't recognize him, and so he hides his goblet in Benjamin's pack, and then says, "Who stole my silver cup?" And then says, "It's me. Don't you recognize me?" And they're worried he's going to punish them. And he says, "Look, I've forgiven you." There's this interesting statement he makes. He says, "You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good." And so this is seen as all part of God's plan, in that if Joseph wasn't sold into slavery and betrayed by his brothers, he wouldn't have gone to Egypt. If he wasn't falsely accused of adultery, he wouldn't have ended up in the dungeon. He's accused of adultery with his master's wife. And if he wasn't in the dungeon, he wouldn't have heard about the Pharaoh's dream and talked to someone who could get him to see the Pharaoh. And then if he didn't interpret the Pharaoh's dream, the Egyptians wouldn't have known to store up all this food for the coming famine, and him and all his brothers would have starved to death. And so this is, seen of all part of God's plan, preserving the seed of Abraham. So this is how Abraham's descendants end up in Egypt. Did you have a comment or question?
I was going to say, isn't one of the main themes is that he's like a faithful servant to his master every time, and it's someone...
Right, that's part of it. It's part of it. Joseph's virtue sort of carries the day in that everyone else is faithless. His brothers, betray him.
Okay.
But I think the theological point, the larger theological point of the writer is in that statement that Joseph makes. This is about what's called God's sovereignty, that God's kind of behind the scenes working his will. And even though it looks like you're making a free will decision, it might be that God's got some plan and your decision is going to be worked into that plan to get things come out the way God wants them. So he says, you did something evil, but God turned it into something good. And it ends up being part of his plan. The Hebrews settle in Egypt, and they are made slaves. They multiply, as the immigrants are wont to do, at a higher birth rate. And people start to think about your Hebrews as like, kind of like your illegal aliens from Mexico. They're like, breeding like crazy. They're going to run over on the country. What are we going to do? I know. Let's make them into a slave class. So instead of, working under the table for minimum wage and with, fake IDs, they're actually made literal slaves. And to cut down the birth rate, they're killing all the male children to prevent a slave insurrection. And so Moses is supposed to be killed, but his mother cleverly puts him in a basket in the Nile River amongst the reeds. And actually, this is kind of interesting here. How many people have here seen like the Disney movie Prince of Egypt? If you ever seen like picture of the Nile River, artistic license, that the Nile River doesn't have rapids like the Colorado. But you see, I think there's some scenes Moses is kind of going down the river, shooting the rapids, and there's the climactic music playing. And no, it's just it's a kind of a marshy area, kind of like think about like Florida, the Everglades. The water, most places in the Nile River, is really small, really slowly. And on the banks, you have these reeds, like bamboo, that's all growing up. And so what she does is she makes a basket for him and kind of floats him in the shallow so she can go out to nurse him every once in a while and change him and then take care of him out in the middle of nowhere where nobody's going to see him and kill him. And what happens is the Pharaoh's daughter, the princess, is bathing, and she sees this poor Hebrew child. Oh, look, a baby, how cute. Oh, I feel sorry for him. Let's I'll adopt him. And then she says, well, I'll need a nursemaid. And, Moses' mother happens to be there. She ends up being Moses' nursemaid, his real mother. And so Moses grows up in two worlds. He is, by adoption, he's a prince of Egypt. But by heritage, he's Hebrew, and he's got this Hebrew mother who's probably telling him the traditions of their people. Moses shows where his loyalties lie when he sees an Egyptian taskmaster beating his slave, and and murders the taskmaster. He gets really angry, and we'll see here, I think we, for the first time, we see Moses' temper, which gets him into trouble later on. But Moses flies into a rage and kills the slave master, beating the Hebrew slave. There's a witness, somebody sees him doing it, and so he has to get out of town. So he ends up settling out sort of in the outlying areas. He gets married, and then he likes to sort of wander around in the hills. It's interesting that if you look at Moses and Jesus and also Muhammad, they like to spend a lot of time alone, by themselves. And this is something you kind of see of mystics and prophets. They seem to like to spend a lot of time alone. And so one of the things that Moses likes to do is sort of wander around in the hills. And that's where he meets God in a burning bush. And it's interesting, when he asks, he sees God, he's like, oh, you're God. He doesn't say, oh, look, it's the one, it's the one true God. He wants to know, well, which God are you? What is your name? Are you Osiris? Are you Isis? Are you, and I think early in the Old Testament, it's not really clear that Yahweh is the only God. He is a jealous God. He doesn't want you worshiping any other gods. It doesn't say, oh, don't worship any other gods because it's a waste of time. They don't exist. There's never the idea that if you worship an idol that you're worshiping Yahweh just in another form under another name, which is sort of the Americanized version of religion, that everybody's worshiping the same God and we just use different names and we pray a different way, but it's all the same God. There's none of that. It's like if you're not worshiping Yahweh, you're not worshiping the true God. But Yahweh is a true God. It doesn't mean there aren't other gods that you're not supposed to worship. And so he says, what's your name? And God says, I am. Again, this is a play on the name Yahweh. And then he introduces himself as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And notice he says to here, this is my name forever to all generations. So it's not like, well, this is kind of like the Jewish name, but later on you get a different name. And I have all kinds of different names. I have so many names. I have, I'm El Shaddai, and I'm what are some of the other names?
Elohim.
And you can use all these different names. No, God has one personal name, Yahweh. And that's the name in the third commandment you're not supposed to misuse. Moses is a reluctant hero. He's a poor public speaker. He says he's slow with speech, and it's not really clear in the Hebrew what that means. He might have had a stutter. He might have just been a poor public speaker. He might have been like somebody's George W. Bush, right? can't put the string of, he's not dumb, but just can't string a sentence together. And, maybe Aaron's more like, Barack Obama or Ronald Reagan or somebody who's, like, really good at making speeches. And God says, well, send your brother Aaron. He's a good speaker. And so that beats down that objection. And so finally he goes, and he gives him some miracles to give him some credibility. So he shows up in Pharaoh's court, says, let my people go. And he says, I'm going to prove that I'm coming from God. See a hand, it's a perfectly healthy hand, not leprous at all. I stick it in my cloak, and it's a leprous hand. Look at that. And stick it in my cloak, and it's perfectly okay. Yeah.
What was that last line on the last page?
Okay. Miracles for credibility. So he's got these miracles. The other miracle is he can turn his staff into a snake. So he takes his staff, throws it down. Ordinary staff. I don't want to touch staff, sir. Okay. Throw it down the ground, and there it is, and it's a snake, and then he picks it up, and it's ordinary staff again. And so this, he has miracles. He obviously must be the representative of a god, to the Pharaoh, and so he tells the Pharaoh, let the Israelites go, let my people go. He tells the Pharaoh that over and over again. The Pharaoh hardens his heart, and why is this? Well, in the first instance, we see Pharaoh hardens his heart and doesn't want to let the Israelites go. Later on, after he gets some plagues, he's like, oh, I don't want any more plagues. I'm going to let them go. But God says, I'm not quite done with the plagues yet. And the Pharaoh wants to let my people go. And so he just, Oh, then he'll harden Pharaoh's heart. So he hardens Pharaoh's heart, so Pharaoh is obstinate, and so God can punish him with more plagues. He wants to pour out all 10. He wants to make a big name for himself. He says, you know, here's what I've made an example of Pharaoh to spread my name throughout the earth. And so he wants to demonstrate his power and authority. So why 10 plagues? Why doesn't God just sort of let off the Pharaoh easy? Well, first of all, he's kind of angry for 400 years of slavery of his chosen people. He wants to demonstrate his power. He wants to spread his name. And also the Israelites get loot. They get all kinds of goodies because the Egyptians want to get rid of them so badly that they load them up with the gold and silver and jewels and just to get rid of them. The last plague is the angel of death, which kills the firstborn. So if you've seen the Ten Commandments, the one with Charlton Heston and Yul Brynner, what's wrong with that episode as portrayed there? Anybody remember that movie? You see old, you know, bald Yul Brynner there, staring down at what, a crib with sort of like shadows and sad music or sort of dramatic music. Well, the firstborn is the first one born who's going to be what? The oldest, right? So the idea of the firstborn is going to be like, unless the Pharaoh doesn't have any children, which I think wasn't the case. So anyway, that I think that the remember, firstborn is that's the eldest son. So the firstborn, who is the most important son, typically the beloved son, and the firstborn, I think, some of the animals are killed too. So what do the Israelites do to survive the angel of death? They have to put blood on their doorposts, and that's a sign that the angel of death needs to pass over their houses. And this is where the celebration of Passover comes from. Passover comes from the angel of death passing over the Hebrew households, not killing the firstborn, and moving on to the next house, where like the Egyptians, where they kill them. The angel knows to pass over the house if it's got the blood on the outside of the door, on the doorposts. So the last plague, the angel of death, escape across the Red Sea. It could be the Red Sea, it could be the Sea of Reeds. It's a bunch of controversy about exactly where they crossed, and we don't have time to get any of that. But they crossed some large body of water. The sea opens, and Moses and the Israelites walk across dry land, and then God closes the waters after them, drowning the Pharaoh and his army. And I would say, if this is like the marshy, reedy shallows of the Sea of Reeds, sort of up near, I'll pull out some maps in a little bit here, up near sort of the Mediterranean Sea, then that's a pretty big miracle to drown an army in 3 feet of water. So I'd say, if you're looking for a way to kind of water down the story or water down the miracle, and you're trying to say, well, I don't believe in miracles, so it had to be the Sea of Reeds, you have to throw out the drowning of Pharaoh and his army too, because it's pretty hard to drown somebody in 3 or 4 feet of water. Moses sings a song afterwards of celebration, and we're given the lyrics. And one of the lyrics, it says, Yahweh is a man of war. He's a warrior. And there's another line which says, Who is like you, O Yahweh, among the gods? Now, why is this a problem for the view that you get a thoroughgoing monotheism throughout the Old Testament?
So it's pluralized.
Yeah, and it assumes that other gods exist. So you get these terms. There's a term for this called... where's my pen? Oh, you got me some more pens. Oh, it's up there. I wonder if I get this on my next slide. I took my next slide here. Every God who is like you among Yahweh among the gods. It's not there. Alright, go back. So monolatry, or sometimes henotheism, which is the idea of one great or true God, and then other lesser or, forbidden or false gods. But a false god doesn't mean your god that doesn't exist. It just means you're a God that's not supposed to be worshipped, and you're not as great as the great true God. So true and false doesn't mean existent or not existent. It means the God you're supposed to worship and the gods who are lesser and minor and paltry in comparison, right? That you're not supposed to worship. So monolatry means the worship of one God. Henotheism is this idea of one sort of great God and lesser God. So they're different words for the same concept, which is this idea of the worship of one God, but with a tacit acknowledgement that there are other gods. They just, you're just not supposed to worship them. And they're lesser gods than this great God. Yeah.
Is that where Satan kind of comes from, the monolatry, where it's like he's lesser than God, but he's greater than man, so he's... But they don't...
Yeah, you can think about him sort of being a God, sure.
Isn't he described as an angel, though?
Yeah, he is. I think people... Satan might function as a god in the sense that people worship him. Satan actually doesn't come in, though, until... I'd say really until the historical books, like the books of... There's just a couple of references to him, I think, in the Book of Kings and First and Second Samuel, maybe. First and Second Samuel, there's two references to him there. The word Satan, I think, only occurs just two or three places in the Old Testament, apart from the Book of Job. So we'll get to Satan later. There's no Satan on the scene as of yet.
Okay.
Finish this thing. So the angel of death passes over the Hebrew houses. This is where you get the ceremony of Passover. It's a spring festival in Judaism, a very important central festival. It's a celebration of the Exodus, or the departure from Egypt. So Exodus means departure. It's actually a Greek word, it's not Hebrew, but it comes from the Septuagint, which is a Greek translation of the Hebrew scriptures. And so the Exodus means the departure from Egypt. But the Passover is a celebration of being free from being slaves in Egypt. It's a defining event. It identifies God as the deliverer, the person who delivers you from trouble, from calamity, and from your sins. And you'll see over and over again in the Tanakh, when God introduces himself, or when God is about to give an important new commandment, or when he's about to tell you something you should listen to, he says, "I am Yahweh, your God, who brought you out of Egypt," just to remind him. And over time, when the Jews have settled down and become agricultural society, and it's been a while since God delivered them from Egypt, you know, they'll say, "Yeah, he's the Lord our God who brought us out of Egypt, but what has he done for us lately? I got a crop I got to get in, and it's, you know, I need some rain." And who specializes in rain? Well, Baal. Baal's the storm god, and so people would go to Baal and to get it to rain, and they kind of do their thing for Yahweh on the side, and or maybe not worship him at all. And this makes Yahweh really, really angry. Did you have a question or comment, or just resting your arm like that?
I'm resting
my
arm.
Okay. Just want to make sure. Passover lamb is a part of that. You know, there are some changes to this. So the Passover lamb, that you're supposed to slaughter a lamb and put blood on the doorposts, that's kind of messy. They don't do that anymore. That sort of went by the wayside about the time, I think, that the Hebrews stopped practicing animal sacrifice, when the temple was destroyed in 70 AD. Unleavened bread is intended to symbolize the haste at which they had to leave. They had to go right away. And so when you're baking bread, it takes a while for the dough to rise. And so they are eating unleavened bread. It's kind of crackle bread, matzah bread. Yeah?
I was just wondering about the angel of death part. Is it the actual angel of death, or is it just actually God going, "That's it, Yahweh, is going to come in"?
Well, I think Yahweh through the angel of death. Because he does say the angel of death is going to pass over your houses. The question, you know, angel just means messenger, so the messenger of death. But the angels are these spiritual beings who serve God and act as his messengers, as his scouts, as his go-to guys that tell, you know, that do things for him, intermediaries. So this is one such angel. Sometimes you see the angel of Yahweh, and there's this question about, is this Yahweh himself, or is this just some angel who's sent by Yahweh? And there might be some ambiguity there. The bitter herbs. Bitter herbs are meant to symbolize the bitter yoke of slavery, of being slave for 400 years. Originally, make sure I have something here. Oh, I do have that there. Maybe this bitter herbs, slavery, unleavened bread, haste. Sorry, I'm going to do this kind of fast. I want to see if we can finish this before we're done, before the witching hour strikes, which is coming up close. Okay, so originally these are eaten in haste, and you're supposed to be dressed to travel. So you'd be sitting there in your chair, dressed in your cloak, with your staff in your hand, and your loins girded up, right? You're ready to dash out the door, and you're supposed to gobble up the food really fast. And that was, you know, part of the ceremony. Today, it's kind of like, you think about it as being kind of like Jewish Thanksgiving, and it's a little more, you don't have to gobble up the food. And they've added some other things there, so some modernization. Sometimes they'll have something else besides lamb they'll substitute, because lamb's kind of expensive and hard to get. Yeah.
It's Passover every week.
No. It's just once a year. Once a year in the spring.
Okay.
Right.
14th.
Yeah, it's 14th Tishri. I don't know, but I can't remember the month. But it falls in the spring. It's, you know, around Easter time. they have also this. There's a pebbly mixture of walnuts and apple and cinnamon, and a little bit of wine, and that's, you know, symbolized the mortar for the bricks. Although kind of anachronistic, right? Because they're making mud bricks, they're even forbidden from having straw, which makes it even harder to make the bricks. But this is part of it. This mix is kind of a sweet mixer. It's got, I think they put sugar in it too. Also vegetables. They have like some green vegetables, or sometimes some potatoes dipped in salt water, which are intended to symbolize the tears. I want to ask you a question on these details. Some of the modernizations that it's changed a little bit over time. So if you go to like a friend's Passover and you're like, hey, the professor said you're supposed to gobble up the food and be dressed to travel, you know. It's changed over time.
So. Come with us.
They got, you know, games for the kiddies, and they have this, find them, you take like a matzo bread and you hide it someplace, and the kids are supposed to find it, kind of like an Easter egg hunt. And there's people exchange gifts sometimes and that sort of thing. Okay. And let's see what I got next. A lot of stuff here. I'm not sure why the egg symbolizes the destruction of the temple, but that's what it's supposed to be about. So obviously, this is way before, the original Passover is way before the temple's destroyed. Okay, I'm going to move on here. On their way out, they're ambushed by the Amalekites. Attacked from the rear, where the old and sick and the defenseless are, and God promises revenge on the Amalekites. And he waits 400 years to get his revenge, and finally says, it's time, I'm going to go wipe out all the Amalekites. And one of the reasons given, can you not click that, please? One of the reasons given for Saul losing his kingship is that he doesn't carry out orders, and he leaves the king alive, and he doesn't slaughter all the animals, but he brings some of them back as spoils for his soldier.
Didn't they originally defeat the Amalekites? They had to hold up, Aaron and somebody else had to hold up his
staff. Right. So there is a battle there, and there's a couple of statements. God says, in one place he says, I'll have the Lord, or Yahweh, will have war against Amalek from generation to generation. And then he also promises, I will blot out the name of Amalek from under heaven. So he promises to completely wipe them out. And then later on, follows through when Saul becomes the first king of Israel. He's got an army. He's got a nation state. Now he can go kill all the Amalekites.
So yeah. The defenseless are slaughtered?
Yeah. There's a word missing there. I'm not sure what happened there. They're slaughtered. The old sick and... Oh, attack from the rear. Where the old sick and defenseless are. There's an attack in the rear where the old sick and defenseless are.
Okay, yeah. So like physically are.
Another important festival, Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur is the Day of Atonement. it's a time where you get rid of all the excess sins. And so there's two goats in Yom Kippur. There's a sacrificial goat where you just sacrifice, it's an ordinary sacrifice. And then there's a scapegoat. And the scapegoat, in the Hebrew, it's Azazel. Later on, in Hebrew, mysticism, it becomes the name of a demon. But here, it's just usually translated scapegoat. What happens is the excess sins of the nation are transferred from the high priest to the goat, and then the goat is driven out into the wilderness. And this has to do with this idea of collective sin, or that God doesn't just have anger at individuals and punish individuals, but his wrath and judgment comes upon the community if there is a sinful individual there. And so whenever you committed sin, you had to pay for it with the sacrifice. Now, what happens if somebody commits a sin and either doesn't realize it's a sin, or they didn't get around to sacrificing for it? Well, God's angry at that person and going to punish them. But he's not going to do the surgical strike. God's going to send a plague, or he's going to send a famine, or some other calamity, like in the insurance form you fill out. Right? It's called an act of God. And that's the way God deals. Right? God sends plagues and famines and earthquakes and pestilence and all these terrible things against the evildoers, even though maybe the people around them aren't so bad, but it's that evildoer he wants to get at. And so what you need to do is make sure that all the sins are paid for. So Aaron, the priest, the high priest, takes on all the sins of the nation, transfers it to the goat, and then you drive that goat out in the desert, and God's wrath follows the goat. And the goat has to pay for the sins.
Isn't there later Christianity, Aaron represents the figure of Christ taking all the atonement? And this is from Leviticus, right?
Right.
Okay.
Today, it's just sort of a time of repentance where you tell God you're sorry for your sins, you reflect on the last year, and you make a resolution to do better. And if you're familiar with Christianity, with the idea of Lent, this is sort of a similar kind of festival today. Not really a festival. A similar time, kind of remembrance in Judaism. That's all we have time for, so we'll start right in with the invasion of Canaan starting on Tuesday.
Are we going to go over the Ten Commandments?
Oh, the Ten Commandments. We'll come back to this. So actually, we'll start right in with the Ten Commandments on Tuesday, and then move into the invasion of Canaan.